And what Dima failed to say was that several of the papers I wrote, both in my PhD and my postdoc, were with him. And so it's great to meet collaborators and new people here. So I'm going to talk about work that I titled in a very general and not very useful way, Fractionalization from Crystallography. I'll try and explain why crystallography might have something to do with fractionalization over this talk. But before I go ahead, I just want to thank people I collaborated with. Most of this work sort of was done with Ashwin Vishwanath and Ari Turner, who are both have Berkeley connections. And the bulk of what I'm talking about today was done following some discussions with Dan Arovas. And it's summed up in this paper over here. But what motivated this work was actually a set of thoughts on constructing interesting wave functions for frustrated magnetic systems with Itamar Kimchi, Fao Wang, and an experimentalist who actually kicked off the whole thing by asking us some pointed questions about his experiments, Dan Stamperkern at Berkeley. So I'm going to motivate this talk by starting to talk about the question of classifying phases and sort of a modern picture of why do metal and insulator transitions have something to do with symmetry and fractionalization. So I want to connect those ideas and try and give you a kind of quantitative reason why we think of Mott insulators as special by connecting them to this notion of topological order and fractionalization. And what I'm going to talk about is how certain crystal symmetries can actually give you interesting results about fractionalization in systems. And then what I'll basically do is try and illustrate those ideas through a series of examples and try and say that thinking about crystal symmetry can be a useful and powerful way of understanding phases of matter in crystals. So if we're classifying phases, probably the easiest way to begin classifying phases is to do this theorist experiment of taking a battery and connecting wires to your system and asking if it transports current. So you can either get a metal or an insulator in that picture. But there's another way of classifying phases in terms of symmetries. For instance, if I think about crystal symmetries, this was work done in the 19th century and early 20th century where people realized that all crystals fall into one of 230 space groups. And it's kind of a cool fact that every space group has at least one mineral that crystallizes in that form, so nothing's wasted. And if you think a little bit about what band theory is telling us, it's really a way of connecting those two pictures of classifying phases. Band theory is a way of saying, let's take symmetry and ask what symmetry tells us about those transport phases in crystals. So if I think of Bloch's theorem and the Schrodinger equation, they give me energy bands. This is a standard calculation in any condensed matter class. And the distinction between metals and insulators has to do with whether the bands are partially filled or fully filled. Of course, this is a non-interacting picture. And when you add interactions, you can get richer physics. And the first rich physics that you can get is symmetry breaking. So for instance, you can think of ferromagnetic and antiferromagnetic orders. You can think of various kinds of charge ordering. And you can think of superfluidity, which is more subtle, but again, we have spectacular consequences for how materials flow. So about 30 years ago, people started, motivated by experiments in the quantum Hall effect, people started asking whether they can be distinct phases, even without symmetry breaking. And I'm sure many people here have seen this motivation before. And that means you can ask about whether there are phases that are featureless but have no symmetry breaking. Featureless in that they have absolutely no structure, even when without these broken symmetries. So if you think of a featureless phase, it's something like, essentially it's some version of what we would think of as a band insulator, including a topological band insulator. The idea is that you have no broken symmetry. So if I dropped you into this material, you wouldn't be able to tell that it was different from the high temperature phase of that same material. But you would know if you had an edge that things were different, for instance, in a band insulator, both a topological, you could tell whether you're in a topological band insulator or a trivial band insulator. But there's no measurement you could do in the bulk of the system in terms of fractionalized degrees of freedom. There's nothing fractionalized in these systems. There's no emergent topological order in these systems. And you can think of quantum paramagnets like the AKLT chain, which is one of this whole class of symmetry-protected topological phases. And you can think of metals and semi-metals as also falling into this class of things that basically break no symmetry, but they also have no interesting physics of fractionalization. And one way of saying it is if they're gapped, they always have a unique ground state in any system, like a torus with periodic boundary conditions. And if they're gapless, spin and charge move at the same velocities. Everything is transported by the same degrees of freedom in a metal. Everything's transported by the electrons. There's no spin-charge separation. So that's what I mean by a featureless phase in both the gapped and gapless instances. But there are also fractionalized phases which also don't break any symmetries. For instance, in 1D, we know that there are Luttinger liquid phases where spin and charge move with different velocities. So there's a notion in which spin and charge are separate in 1D systems. And in 2D, you have more exotic things like topological order and the fractional quantum Hall effect. So you can have fractionalized charge in statistics. And of course, you have gapped and gapless spin liquids. And in all these cases, you'll see that if the system is gapped, there's a degenerate ground state on a torus, which is what happens in the fractional quantum Hall effect and then spin liquid states. And in all these cases, you have some kind of fractionalized quantum numbers in that you have excitations that carry spin but no charge or charge but no spin. So one way you could ask is, suppose I handed you this a phase of matter that had no broken symmetries. Can you say something about what phase it's in, whether it's in one of these featureless phases or whether it has some more interesting structure? Now, if you wanted to detect fractionalization, you could say, well, it turns out fractionalized phases encode their physics in entanglement. And it's particularly clear in the gap case because, as Kitaev and Preskill and Levin and Wen separately showed, you can actually measure the entanglement entropy of ground states. And if you do clever constructions, you can actually extract a topological part of the entanglement entropy that serves, in some sense, as an order parameter for telling you if you have a fractionalized phase with a gap. But the problem is we don't have a, if you're an experimentalist, you want to go and measure entanglement, it's hard to find cases when you can measure it in simple sense. There are some examples where you can measure something like an entanglement, but it's tricky. So we don't have an entanglometer that we can hook up. And in some numerical implementations, it's harder to measure entanglement than others. It's sometimes possible if you have a variational wave function, you have DMRG, it's possible to measure entanglement simply. But there are techniques where measuring entanglement in a ground state wave function is not an obviously easy thing to do. Although in those two examples I've said, pioneers of measuring entanglement are in this room, and especially when it comes to variational Monte Carlo. Roger's done a lot of work on measuring entanglement there. But it's hard to measure in generic numerical systems. If you don't have something like exact diagonalization, if you're doing determinantal Monte Carlo, it can be tricky to measure entanglement, although there are now proposals to do that. And experimentally, it's really hard. What we could do is check various symmetries and ask if all symmetries aren't broken, whether the system is still in an interesting phase. That's a way you can ask, I may not be able to measure entanglement, but imagine I can measure symmetry breaking with arbitrary precision and look at various complex order parameters. And I see that I don't have any order parameter that's non-zero for any broken symmetry. Can I argue the system is in a phase that's featureless, or does it have to have fractionalization? So it's going to ask, if I have no broken symmetries, what are the possibilities I can get with no broken symmetry? So one example you can think of is a band insulator is gapped and breaks no symmetries and has a unique ground state in a periodic system. This is sort of your classic caricature of a 1D band insulator. But imagine you were instead at half filling. So imagine I have the same 1D chain. I have a 1D chain of electrons, say the Hubbard model, with up and down spins. When I'm at very high interaction strength, much bigger than T, you get a Heisenberg antiferromagnet. You can sort of think of the effective theory as being that of the Heisenberg chain. And here there's a famous result by Lieb, Schultz, and Mattis from about 40 years ago that says the spin a half Heisenberg chain is always gapless. And you can check that if you think of it like that, you say, well, at large interaction strength, the charges don't move, so it's really like a charge insulator. But the spin is gapless, so it's like a spin metal. So if you like, that's a nice example of spin charge separation in the ground state. So you have gapless spin excitations, but all your charge degrees of freedom are frozen. And in fact, there's a charge gap for all finite U. If you work out the details for this 1D Hubbard model, you can actually solve it exactly. So if I take these as examples, you can ask, why are these two examples different? I have the featureless example and a spin charge separated example. Both are in 1D. And what makes them different is, what makes them different is the fact that they sit at different fillings. So if you actually count the charge in each unit cell of these two 1D crystals, you find that in the example to the left, you have an integer charge at each site of the unit cell. And it turns out whenever you have integer filling in one dimension, you can adiabatically connect that problem to a band insulator. And I'll qualify what I mean by adiabatic continuity to a band insulator in a second. So even if the particular example that you look at needed interactions to get that thing, so you take a particular tight binding model and that one may need some interaction, the idea is that in the universe of all possible models, there is some non-interacting problem that could give you essentially the same physics. Whereas at fractional filling, there's no adiabatic continuity to band insulator. There's no band insulating way you could ever describe that gapless phase. Unless the only way you could ever map this onto a band insulator and get a gap is if somehow you break a symmetry and redefine the unit cell. But that changes the filling. Because you change the unit cell, you change the filling of the crystal. So what's protecting these two? Yeah?
So is it the first case, okay, filling, are you announcing a theorem? Or are you saying that that's from the impression that people have?
The impression that they have. Like, I'm going to show you that the sort of distinction between integer and fractional is A, more subtle. If you like, the theorem exists for fractional filling. I'm going to qualify what that theorem is. This is Hastings' theorem at fractional filling. At integer filling, you can't guarantee it. You can't guarantee it. But what you can argue, you could find that the phase has, what I'm trying to say is that what you can really say is that at fractional filling, this is completely impossible. Right. At integer filling, it's either possible or not. We can't argue. Okay. What I'm going to try and show you is that there are cases even at integer filling where you can guarantee it's not true. That's the interesting, I would say. There are cases where you have essentially filled bands in the sort of band picture, but you can never open a gap. That's what I'm going to try and show in the rest of the talk. So what are the ingredients you need? So I want to make this notion of no adiabatic continuity. As you'll see, the thing I'm making more precise is the fact that there's no continuity. I can't make adiabatic continuity precise because that would require me to construct such an adiabatic path, and a given model may not let me do that. But I can show that no such path exists, and that's what I'm going to try and show. So let me give you the minimal requirements. So everything in my talk is going to apply to systems that have a crystal structure and a conserved global U1 charge. And I'll define what that global U1 means, but I just mean that there's something I can count and take the total number of that over the whole system and define some total global conserved charge. And if you like, those are exactly the two ingredients I need to describe. I can't define a filling without both those ingredients, because a filling is charge per unit cell. So I need to have a notion of charge that I can conserve, and I need to have a number of unit cells that I can count. And so any system which has a crystal structure and global U1, I can define a filling. And this notion of adiabatic continuity of a band insulator being absent can be made precise. And there's a theorem that sort of goes by a complicated name, Hastings, Oshikawa, Liebschultz, Mattis. Liebschultz and Mattis essentially proved this theorem in 1D. Oshikawa gave a very nice argument of how to extend it in 2D that was made rigorous by Matt Hastings, because there were some subtleties missed in Oshikawa's proof. Most of what I'll tell you today will sort of work in this Oshikawa language, and I'll point out where that fails to be rigorous and how you can fix that. But I'm going to sort of give you sort of sketch pictures for this talk, because I don't want to go into a epsilon delta proof type of discussion today. So the theorem essentially says, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it says whenever you have a system with a U1 charge and a crystal structure, whenever that U1 charge is at fractional filling, whenever you have fractional filling of charge, a unique gapped translationally invariant insulating ground state is impossible. So we can ask, what are the alternatives? What does this allow at fractional filling? Well, you could either remain metallic, so your charge just travels freely. That's allowed. You could also break a symmetry, but of course, when you break a symmetry, what you're really doing is redefining the filling. If you double the unit cell, you have twice the filling you started with before, because you're defining the filling the new unit cell. But there are more interesting options. For instance, you could insulate but remain gapless. So in fact, imagine your system has two U1 symmetries, like the Hubbard model example I gave you earlier. Well, you're insulating with respect to the charge U1, but you're metallic with respect to the spin U1. So that example is a case where you have spin charge separation. Or you could give up on having a unique ground state, and you could have a ground state degeneracy and have topological order. And these are really the only ways you can get out of this theorem, because if this is a theorem, these are the only four possibilities that we know. And so these two are interesting, and whereas these two are boring. But both of these, note that both of these can be tested, because you can check if you broke a symmetry experimentally, and you can check if your system is metallic, because you can essentially do a measurement of whether the system is an insulator or a metal in any, and check whether it was metallic or insulating with respect to that U1 charge that you gave. So if I don't see either of these behaviors, it must be one of these, and it's easy to check if the system has a gap or not. So you can sort of distinguish between all these alternatives pretty easily in some system. So this, I would take this as the strict definition of no adiabatic continuity. These two cases are exactly when I can't do anything interesting. So this broken symmetry case, I've got a new crystal, and so there I can define some band, I could imagine constructing a band insulator which had the same properties. So what I'm going to show is that in these two cases, what I'm going to argue is that this is what I mean by no adiabatic continuity. If my system has spin charge separation or topological order, it can never be represented in any way as a band insulating phase. That's the argument I'm going to give. So I'm going to try and show that this theorem extends to other examples. So why would we care about such a theorem? What that basically told you, if you went through that list, is it said, if you have a gap, so that removes the metallic case and it removes the case of having a gapless system with spin charge separation. And if you have no symmetry breaking, the only alternative on that table of ways to satisfy that theorem was to be fractionalized and have topological order. And that means that it strongly constrains your possible phases. So for instance, if you're doing numerics on the Kagame lattice Heisenberg model, and suppose you did experiments, so for instance, Steve White at Irvine did this numerical work in this famous science paper where he saw a gap but no broken symmetries. Well, if you count the charge in this per unit cell of this model, you find that in the way I'll show you how to define filling correctly for that model, you're at actually half integer filling, which means you cannot be featureless by this previous argument. And that's one way you can conclude that the ground state must be some quantum spin liquid phase. Of course, now we know that there's a smoking gun signature, which is to calculate the entanglement entropy. And Jiang Wang and Balentz did that about a year after this original science paper, and that seems to confirm this prediction. But we might still want to have cases where the entanglement entropy is hard to calculate, or if you're thinking in a perspective of asking, where should I look in a material, where should I think of frustrating order in order to get interesting spin-liquid behavior, it's a good idea to say, well, we start with an odd number of electrons per unit cell. And in fact, this even goes back to Ashcroft and Merman. If you look there, they say a Mott insulator is a case when you have an odd number of electrons per unit cell, because band theory would always tell you that system is metallic. So what would happen if I think about integer unit cell filling? I don't have any theorem that tells me anything, right? Remember this said, at fractional unit cell filling, there's no adiabatic continuity to band insulator. So suppose I saw a gap and I saw no symmetry breaking. Well, what happens? There was some interest. So when we did this work, we were very interested in this honeycomb lattice Hubbard model example where people had done numerics that seemed to suggest what was a quantum spin liquid phase. And I think later on, there was more careful analysis of this data, and people did more better finite size scaling, and they found that that phase essentially shrunk away. But at the time we were doing it, we said, suppose somebody gave you this information that said, on the honeycomb lattice, I have some spin model, and I try and do some analysis of broken symmetry in that model. I do some simulation where I see a gap and no symmetry breaking. Can I immediately conclude that that phase is a spin liquid? So we felt it didn't have to be, and we actually were able to cook up a counterexample. We could construct an SU2 symmetric insulating phase of fermions, which is what this model had, which had no fractionalization. Now, it turned out that the thing we constructed didn't quite have the symmetry as the Hubbard model, but if you think about it, the fact that you could do such a thing and construct a featureless insulating state, that would look, it has a finite correlation length, it has a spin gap. So if you looked at it in every way, it would look very similar to the spin liquid in the numerics that they did, because it would show you no broken symmetry for any, it would show you no broken symmetries. But it doesn't have any topological order. In fact, for this model, we could prove that it was adiabatically continuable to a band insulator, because essentially that's the idea, that's the way we built it.
Is the global U1 part of SU2?
What?
Is the global U1 part of SU2?
Yeah, in this case, the global U1 is part of the SU2. If you like, we started with a global U1 for a boson number for our model. So we constructed a thing that was insulating with respect to that. And then we took that boson to be, we showed that it didn't matter if it was hardcore. And that boson we now interpret as a Cooper pair. Because if you think of a hardcore boson, a Cooper pair has the same structure as a hardcore boson. You can't put two on one site. That's basically what we did. So that's how we got a U1, really, for our problem. So in this case, in fact, I won't be. What I'll argue is that with even just U1 symmetry, you can't construct a featureless insulator. You can always construct a featureless insulator, even with reduced symmetry. So maybe that, and even with SU, with enhanced symmetry, also you can do it. So does honeycomb, I'm going to show you an example where this is happening, that you can actually construct a featureless insulating phase. But it turns out if you think of what the natural generalization of honeycomb to 3D is, if you say, let me think of a bipartite lattice structure in 3D that I can think of, you would say the diamond lattice is a nice bipartite lattice I can think of in 3D, which has sort of hexagons fundamentally in it. You tried the same construction in 3D on the diamond lattice, and you can show that it'll never work. Because it turns out an integer filling on the diamond lattice you can never construct. With one spin a half per side of the diamond lattice, any gap spin gap ground state has to break symmetry or have topological order, and that's what I'll prove in the rest of the talk. Which again, you would not get out of Hastings' theorem. It doesn't tell you anything. It's two sites per unit cell. Yeah.
So just to summarize, you say at the integer filling.
Yeah.
When you can have a gap and no symmetry breaking.
Yeah.
And yet not have topological order.
In this case, in this particular case of the diamond of the honeycomb lattice.
But is there any theorem that says anything about that integer filling gap and no symmetry breaking? Is there any theorem?
That's what I'm going to tell you for the rest of this talk, in fact. I'm going to show you a theorem that works. I'm going to quantify exactly when you can make a statement about integer filling and gaps and no topological order. It turns out it cannot apply to the honeycomb. It says honeycomb has the ability to have a featureless phase with no topological order. But that same theorem applied to the diamond lattice or hexagonal close packing, simple 3D lattices, will tell you that it's impossible there. So that's what I'm going to try and show you. And I'll show you a 2D example also where it's impossible. So it sort of asks exactly how much can we say about different lattices on the basis of crystal symmetry is what we're going to try and argue. So as I said, in this talk, I'm going to ask, when is a featureless phase forbidden at an integer filling? That's what I'm going to try and answer. Are there any cases when we can say that this sort of, when at integer filling, any phase of matter that's spin-gapped or is insulating has to be somehow an interesting phase of matter? That's what we're going to ask. And the key idea will be to actually use the full crystal symmetry of the problem. Because if you think about, I'll show you that Hastings' theorem used only a very small part of the crystal symmetry. It only used the fact that crystals have translational invariants. But real crystals, when you start talking about space groups, have lots of other symmetries. They have structure to them, like point group symmetries. And we're going to ask exactly how much can those point group symmetries further constrain the phases of matter you're allowed in crystals. That's the kind of specific thing I'm going to try and do for the rest of this talk. And just to keep help us thinking, I want to phrase a related band theory problem. So just to make it into a non-interacting problem in some sense. Suppose I give you exactly one spinless fermion in each unit cell of your crystal. And it's very important that when I count filling, I always count filling per unit cell. I will never in this talk about filling of sites. Filling will always mean the charge per unit cell because that's the fundamental symmetric unit. And I give you a specified crystal. And when I say a specified crystal, I say the only specification I can give about a crystal mathematically in terms of symmetry is what space group that crystal has. That's the only information I give you. I don't give you any more information. So that means you can pick any tight binding model consistent with that space group. So that means that you have the freedom to add sites, change any hopping you want as long as it remains local. I can't add long range hopping, of course. Tune whatever on-site energy you want. The only rules are you respect all the crystal symmetries when you do this, and you don't add anything long range. So I've given you one spinless fermion per unit cell, so exactly enough to fill bands of spinless fermions. So the problem is, can you always find a band insulator? Notice that this is not restricted to any tight binding problem. If I'm allowed to add sites and tune any hopping I want, it's not saying something about any particular tight binding model. It's saying something about all possible tight binding models consistent with that symmetry. So in the world of all possible tight binding models, or world of all possible periodic potentials with that symmetry, is there an insulator at that filling? And the really surprising answer is that there exist crystals for which this answer is resoundingly no. And in fact, 2/3 of the three-dimensional crystals fall into the category for which the answer is no. So what I'm going to do, the primary tool I'm going to use to make arguments that work for interacting systems, so it turns out you can prove some of these statements step by step for non-interacting systems without any of the technology I'm going to develop, but it's painful. It turns out by introducing a very simple idea of what I call flux insertion, it's essentially a generalization of Laughlin's argument for the quantum Hall effect, I'm going to be able to make interesting statements about all these systems that will hold up even with interactions. Because as you'll see, there's going to be no stage here where I require the system to be weakly interacting. The basic idea is to prove the non-uniqueness of a ground state by constructing a degenerate state. So I'm going to assume that I have an insulating ground state, and I'm going to show you with the assumption of having an insulating ground state, I can always construct a new ground state. And then I have some symmetry that I wanted to preserve. As long as that symmetry is preserved, I'm going to show you that the two states that I have before and after this construction procedure are going to be distinct because they have different symmetry quantum numbers. That's the basic argument. And so the whole game is going to be what symmetries I use and if I can get a good understanding of what the symmetries are. So suppose I hand you a ground state. How do you get another state? Well, I have a conserved charge in the system. And I can think of that conserved charge as having a dual magnetic flux. And I can thread 2 pi flux through, if I think of the system as having periodic boundary conditions, I can thread 2 pi flux through the appropriate torus, right? And since that's one flux quantum, now typically I would expect that there'll be some change in energy in the process. But what you can prove, and in a sense what Matt Hastings proved in very careful detail, is that you can always bound the change in energy of this process, and you can show that in this process of inserting flux, the energy of the system must go to zero in the thermodynamic limit if it's insulating. So that you can think of as a definition of an insulator, that energy is going to zero in the thermodynamic limit. So in this process, it tells me that I started with some state, I threaded 2 pi flux, and I get a degenerate state. So you could ask if the state is really a distinct state. So to check if two states are distinct, one way of guaranteeing two states are distinct is to argue that some quantum number changed in the cycle. So what I'm imagining is that I start with some state, and I end up with, you know, I should imagine these two states as essentially degenerate. I've split them just to show what the cycle is doing. Should really think of these as adiabatic, as two degenerate states. And as I go through this flux insertion procedure, I exchange these states. So I end up in a new ground state. So basically the idea is that I got two states that switch their roles as I thread 2 pi flux through the system. And so that tells me there's a ground state degeneracy in the system. It takes 4 pi periodicity or 6 pi, it takes more than 2 pi periodicity to get back to the original ground state. So you can think of this as a sort of spectral flow process. Now, it turns out the subtleties of inserting flux in a system which actually has a ground state degeneracy mean that what I told you is a little bit of a trick. If you go back and ask, well, suppose I had a topologically ordered state and I'm doing this flux insertion in a finite system. Well, in a finite system, even a topologically ordered phase will have exponentially small splitting between the two. You know, the two ground states will actually hybridize exponentially weakly. But that's a very small splitting. So if I did flux insertion the way I traditionally do it, which is exactly adiabatically, I'll actually never jump this level crossing that I get. There's an avoided crossing in any finite system. So essentially, the great work that Matt did was actually to figure out, one thing you can phrase is, one of the big things he did was figure out a way to do this flux insertion quasi-adiabatically, so you can actually effectively jump that level crossing and get to the other state, if you like. So Matt sort of found ways to do this in a rigorous argument, but the picture is still similar, that I'm trying to thread 2pi flux in some ways to construct a new ground state that I can guarantee is degenerate, but then I can ask about quantum numbers as long as my procedure didn't break some symmetry.
Yep. I didn't understand your comment on the exponentially suppressed
yeah.
graph. So,
yeah.
So that's when the boundary conditions correspond to no flags.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that
when you insert the flags, that has an impact
on
the spectrum.
That's right. So you might worry that you don't end up in the new ground state if you do it adiabatically, right? You want to jump. You want to change quantum numbers. So imagine I had two ground states that were distinct.
The gap may remain finite during the...
Well, the thing is, when you close the gap, how do you guarantee you went into the other state? You might not be able to do that. So what Matt was doing was he worried about this detail. One thing he worried about was this. This quasi-adiabatic thing is basically a way of jump, at least the way I understand it, he may paraphrase it quite differently. The way I understand it is that you want to do flux insertion in a way that guarantees that this quantum number changes. If it could, you know, if there's a way for it to change in the cycle, it will change. You don't want to be in this accidental place where you don't actually change this quantum number. That's really, yeah. So it's a technical digression. You don't really need it for the proof. When we sent the email, we were worried about this, so we emailed Matt, and one thing he said was, you can easily make this argument rigorous with quasi, like truly rigorous to the mathematical physics level of rigor with quasi-adiabatic continuity, because that's what you would need. But since Oshikawa's argument sort of gave you the flavor of what you needed, just told you the symmetry number, symmetry quantum number to look at, if you're just using it to identify the symmetry quantum number, you can just use the sort of simplified version of the argument that I did. It's just if you really want to make a rigorous proof, you have to do more work, is what I was trying to say. And that's why this is not at the same level as Hastings' theorem, I would say, at this point, because you'd have to do that extra step. But we know we can do it, so we didn't actually sit and do it. Yeah?
Can you say again why the conserved charge is important?
The conserved charge is important? Absolutely. So if I don't have a conserved charge, I need a conserved charge to define a boundary condition on something, right? So I want to twist some. I want to create something that twists the boundary conditions for the problem, and I want to define everything in terms of a charge, because otherwise I don't have a notion of filling the system. The charge is what I need to define a filling, and in terms of that filling, I can ask, how does the symmetry act on the ground state? So I really want to say something about this U1 charge in the system. You'll see, basically what I need is some version of electrodynamics in the system, because I want to count, I want to be able to apply essentially a force on the charges and ask how their momentum changes, right? So if you think about this procedure of inserting flux, if I have a conserved flux in the system, they better, if I have a flux that I can insert a 2pi flux, then there has to be a conserved charge. There has to be a dual thing to that flux. Otherwise I can't twist the boundary conditions properly.
But, I mean, all this talking about flux, in the end, you'll take the boundary conditions and you'll twist them.
That's what I'll really do.
By
yeah.
Pi.
Yeah.
That's what you're going
yeah. to do. But the thing is, I want to be able to count the effect of that. So if I don't have a U1 charge, I really can't account for the change. And, you know, it's kind of tricky to define what I mean by twisting the boundary conditions for each charge, right? What I do is put a vector potential on. So I need a conserved charge to write that. You know, if I think of a boundary condition, it's equivalent to some vector potential. And if I don't have a U1 charge, I don't really know how to do that properly. That's why I need a U1 charge, if you like. But yeah, you can think of everything here as either threading flux or twisting boundary conditions. If you look back, I'll come to this at the end. What I'm really doing is showing you something kind of which we could have guessed by drawing pictures. I'm going to show you that there's no way to define a polarization for some of these systems. And you know polarization is like an order parameter being in an insulator. So if you can't define a polarization, it has to be metallic. That's sort of a vague argument you can give for why this works. There's no consistent way to define a polarization except at certain fillings for many crystals. That's a way you can phrase it. And it turns out Hastings' theorem is really a statement about polarization, if you think about it. There's a way to map it to that. So let me give you this poor man's proof of the Hastings-Oshikawa-Liebschultz-Mattis theorem. So let's imagine I take a system on the torus and I start in its ground state. So I'm going to thread a quantum of flux and follow the ground state. So I'm using the fact that it's an insulator, so the energy is unchanged. So I start with psi naught and I end up in a state psi zero twiddle. And this is degenerate the ground state by assumption if I'm in an insulator. The question is this a degenerate state? So I'm going to give you this sort of pictorial argument. You can make this more rigorous by being careful. But let me imagine thinking of electromagnetism and thinking in terms of Faraday's law. I had a flux that was inserted through the system. So that flux is going to introduce an electric field. And that's going to give me a force on all the charges in my system. So I can just calculate the total force on the charges and then integrate it to get the total change in momentum of the system. And over, essentially, the total, remember that the Faraday's law tells me something about the, basically the force is going to be d phi dt. So if I integrate it over the entire cycle, the total impulse, the total momentum transfer is some multiple of 2 pi. And if you do it carefully, you can show that the change in momentum of the system is 2 pi times, if I inserted the flux in this direction, call that x, it'll be the transverse dimension will show up, ny, times the filling. And the filling had to show up because you had exactly because you had you want to calculate this for each electron, because each electron moves under this. So if you like, what I really calculated was, let's see, I have, if you work it out, you have the force on the electron. I'm going to set charge to 1 and set h bar to 1. The force is just 1 over lx d phi dt, because the EMF is d phi dt, so the force is the EMF over a distance. And I want to sum it over all charges, so the flux seen by each charge. And so if I the change in momentum of the system is just the integral from 0 to the total time, which is just 1 over lx times the number of electrons, the number of charges in your system, times 2 pi, because the total flux was 2 pi in my units. And that is just equal to mu times lx ly times 2 pi, which is just 2 pi mu ly, which is exactly the formula I have for a 2D system. I guess I called it n sub y there, because it's measured lengths in terms of lattice constants. So this is the total change in momentum of the system. So why is this interesting? Well, if I had a non-lattice system, that would be a huge momentum. But of course, I have a system that's on a lattice. So I don't know that momenta are distinct in a lattice if they differ by reciprocal lattice vectors. So if I actually see that this delta p is 2 pi times an integer in this case, then I would find that the crystal momentum was the same at the beginning and the end. But if this delta p is not a multiple of 2 pi, then even in the reduced symmetry of the lattice, I can actually tell that I changed the momentum. So I changed the crystal momentum, which is the actually good conserved quantity in the lattice. And so this guarantees for me that psi zero twiddle is zero, because they have different quantum numbers, and I can choose ground states to start with different, to have different eigenvalues of that. So this is essentially why you can argue the ground state can't be unique at a fractional nu. Because at a fractional filling, I can always choose ny to be such that that combination is a fractional. And so then you can say that I can take a thermodynamic limit of the system where I always work at ny such that ny times nu is a fraction. And in that thermodynamic limit, at that sequence of fillings, I have to have a ground state degeneracy. And the only way to make that consistent with with the case when ny times nu is an integer is that there's always a ground state degeneracy in the system. That's a really rigorous way of saying what you can say. Every time ny times nu is a fraction, you have a ground state degeneracy. The only consistent thermodynamic limit is that in the infinite system limit, you have a ground state degeneracy. Otherwise, you'd have a contradiction. So let's actually look at a picture of what happens in the reciprocal lattice, because it will motivate why additional symmetries are interesting. So let me start with some ground state. I end up in another ground state, and I know the change in momentum of the system. So suppose this change, this filling was some, say, let's be for specificity, let's say there's a half charge per unit cell of this U1, right? Then your change in momentum really is some is half of a reciprocal lattice vector. Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question in your previous argument. Where do you use the fact that the final state is also ground state? For example, your argument doesn't work for a metal, okay?
Yeah, but the reason is that because I said that there was, I only made the statement that there's a ground state degeneracy. So I'm saying that if I have an insulator, right? This argument always works, right? The change in momentum of the system is always going to work.
Yeah.
The only question is, how does the system accommodate the change in momentum?
For example, if it is metal, then new state will not be a ground state.
Yeah, but that's the point. If it's a metal, I'm done, right? I don't even start. I said if it's an insulator, mm-hmm. what I constructed at the end of the cycle has to be another state, another ground state. Mm-hmm. If it's an insulator, the result of this insertion must be a ground state. That's all I said. Mm-hmm. If you follow the argument, is if it's an insulator, I can always construct this ground state. If it's a metal, I'm done. I don't even start the argument, right? Because remember, the thing is, if it's an insulating phase, then I have a ground state degeneracy. If it's a metal, I wouldn't even enter this phase of the argument.
So you just say that you assume that the new state is also ground state because it is an insulator.
I don't assume. It's true, right? Because if it's an insulator, flux insertion can't change the energy. If you think about, one way you can argue it is, if I do this, there's some currents flowing in the system, but that current in the insulator is bounded. So if you do it, it turns out you get a very weak bound if you do it carefully. That's what Masaki Yoshikawa did in his first proof. Matt was able to give a more rigorous bound that allows you to say that it actually goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit. Like you can show that the splitting in energy always goes to zero in an insulator.
It goes exponentially.
Yeah, I think it goes exponentially in Matt's argument.
So are you using the fact that there is a finite gap to low energy excitations?
That's right.
Even during flux insertion?
That's right.
That as you twist the boundaries, this gap doesn't close. Is that what you're using?
Essentially.
Okay.
Basically, that's energy is way above the ground.
You don't close the gap.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm saying. But I'm always using that fact. So I'm not, if it's a metal, I wouldn't even start with this. There's interesting things you can say about a metal from flux insertion. But that's more to do with Luckinger's theorem and how to count the total volume of the Fermi surface. That's a separate thing we're still thinking about. That's a subtle point. But for an insulator, it's simple. The energy is going to be, the end of this procedure is going to be a degenerate state. I didn't prove that. I would have to tell you Matt Hastings proved it, because if you do it naively, you get something messed up. You find that the bound isn't tight enough that you can say anything about a 3D system. So you can say something about 2D, you can't say anything about 3D. And Matt Hastings' version of it was giving you a bound that was, you know, in a mathematical sense, tight. So you could, it didn't depend on the dimension in which you did it. You can show it, you do it in any dimension, the bound was always the same. That's why it's a little bit more subtle than I planned here. So the exact nature of bounding the difference in energy, given that it's insulating, is subtle. But if you'll take my word for it that it can always be bounded and it goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit, then what I did was construct another state. And the only question is that new state distinct from the one I started with? Is that fair? Good. Now, let's say I set a mu equals a half, and that's the change in momentum. And so if I look at this, I say, well, even in the lattice, this momentum is distinguishable because it's not equivalent to zero under the reciprocal lattice vectors. So that's one way of saying that I know I have a new ground state, because if I happen to have changed the momentum where I took it from some state to another point over here, that point is in the reciprocal lattice, so I can just absorb that. That momentum is equivalent to zero in the crystal. So I couldn't ever tell the difference in the symmetry of the crystal that I got a new state. And that's actually why, if you had mu equals 1, suppose I had filling 1 instead. You actually did this argument, you find that the wave vector sits at a Bragg peak. Anytime the wave vector sits at a Bragg peak in a crystal, I can't tell the difference between that and zero. So it tells me that I couldn't distinguish these two ground states, which is why, if you think about it, Hastings, Oshikawa, these arguments fail at integer filling.
But it shows that you cannot distinguish these two states from
momentum. Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they are the same.
It doesn't yet mean that they're the same. So what I'm going to ask, it could be that they're different, but you can't make any conclusion. You can't say that I have a ground state degeneracy from this, right? There's no guarantee. They could have finite overlap and then you're done. So the question is, can I argue there's a ground state degeneracy? So it turns out, suppose there was actually a missing, suppose I imagined, I guess I've got that repeated. So let's imagine I have a missing Bragg peak. So I actually ended up where I thought there should be a Bragg peak, but there's actually a Bragg peak not absent in the crystal. So I'll motivate where this comes from in a second. But basically, imagine that that Bragg peak wasn't there for some reason. It was precisely zero Bragg amplitude at that point. Then I could maybe guess that these two things are distinguishable, that these two states could somehow be different. But it's now tied, this question of whether I can distinguish the ground states, to something that's completely independent of the phase I was in. It just said something about what the nature of the crystal was. It tied it into some property of the scattering pattern from the crystal. It didn't ask any other detail. It just said, suppose there was no Bragg peak there, then I would be able to say something interesting. And this should be reasonable to us, because the absence of Bragg peaks is really a statement about symmetry. Right? When a Bragg peak in scattering exactly vanishes, there's some symmetry in the crystal that's forcing it to vanish when it's exactly zero. So the question is, when do Bragg peaks vanish in crystals? If we can find a reason for Bragg peaks to be missing from symmetry scattering patterns, then we have a clue of what symmetry quantum numbers we can use to distinguish those two states, if you like.
So,
yeah.
Regarding this Hastings argument.
Yeah.
So when n y is even integer.
Right.
So
you can't say anything.
You cannot say anything.
Yeah. But the point is, let's say I take nu equals a half.
Yeah.
Right? The fact that it's important in Hastings' argument that nx drops out, because I could always pick nx to be even, because you realize you always need to have an even number of total sites in the system at half filling, because your total charge better be an integer. So you can take nx to be even and take ny to be odd. And let me take some, so let me imagine doing something where nx equals ql. Ny equals 2L plus 1, right? That defines a sequence of states in the thermodynamic limit,
yeah,
which I can embed in a more general thermodynamic limit. But that's some particular sequence of taking the thermodynamic limit. And if we believe that the thermodynamic limit should be independent, in particular, it should include this sequence. It should be independent of the way I take it. So it has the only way to be consistent is to have the ground state degeneracy. It doesn't work the other way around. I can't say there's a unique ground state can never be consistent with this. So I'm agnostic when ny is even. When ny is odd, I know I have to have a ground state degeneracy. The only thing that can be consistent is there's also a ground state degeneracy when ny is even. I can't prove it, but it better be there.
Because in principle, even side can behave.
You could do that, but in principle, that could be. I would say that's a system that's sort of pathological in thermodynamic limit, right? There's something non-generic about that. I mean, if you have something that's systematically behaving differently in odd and even, and that persists all the way to the thermodynamic limit, what do you mean by the thermodynamic limit of the system?
So you're saying there's no such counting.
Well, I'm sure you could construct a counterexample, but I feel like those would always be somehow pathological. They're not reasonable systems, right? If you perturb them, they shouldn't be some stable phase. You might worry about something like that.
Well, no, but there are crazy systems in three dimensions, right? Which are even crazier than this. So the thermodynamic limit, depending on, you have to take powers of some basic numbers. NY has to be some power,
right,
for to have a sequence.
Right.
This is the work of...
This guy who worked with Kitaev, right?
What's his name?
Excluding things that...
Shown that these are phases of matter, so things can be created.
They can be created.
They are robust against perturbations.
Right.
So
maybe I'm agnostic on those two. I would say that...
No, agnostic in which sense?
Okay, so I could say that these are phases, but then I don't know. Maybe this is a phase that's even odd. I would assume that everything is... I would say the easiest way for this to work is everything is consistent with what happens at odd end, but you could also have a phase where odd and even are completely different. I agree with you.
Right.
Yeah, you could have that. It's
possible.
Could
be a robust feature.
This could be a robust... Yeah, it could be that. I'm just trying to say that the sort of... A simple example would be you just make it degenerate for all of them, right? That's one way out. But you're right that there could be more. I shouldn't be so hasty as to say that that's the only thing that can happen. It's possible that you could get it. What I am proving is that there's at least a ground state degeneracy at every odd end in this case. And then you might say, okay, one way to make it satisfied is there's always a ground state degeneracy, or there's this even odd effect. Maybe that's there. So I'm going to be agnostic on that point, to be fair. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I shouldn't say more than that. But at least I'm proving that there's a degeneracy. So there'll be some set of things where there's always a degeneracy in these examples. So let's look at where these crystals have this interesting property, for instance. So it does have, if you look at crystals that have systematically missing peaks and Bragg structure, there are two things that could happen. One way you could get missing peaks and Bragg structure if you chose the unit cell poorly. So imagine if you took an FCC crystal and you wanted to choose some unit cell which had more than one site per unit cell. You could take a very complicated unit cell for an FCC crystal. You'd expect some simple Bragg peaks. Like if you took FCC and you took a cubic unit cell, you'd expect a lot more Bragg peaks than you actually get, because FCC has perfect destructive interference. But imagine you took the smallest unit cell you could consistent with the crystal symmetries. You might still see missing Bragg peaks. And it turns out that class of crystals with missing peaks turn out to be what are called non-symmorphic crystals. And there's a very mathematical and simple definition of how crystals work. It turns out if you take your crystals, what the ingredients of a crystal are to have a space group and a translation group. And the crystal can do two things. It can be a semi-direct product of these, which means every operation of the crystal is first do a rotation and then do a translation by a lattice vector. But then there exist crystals that when you put these two symmetry groups together, you get operations that are combined operations of a rotation followed by a translation. But the translation is not a symmetry on its own. It's not a lattice translation. And the rotation is not a symmetry on its own. For instance, if I look at the hexagonal close pack structure, all these sites are equivalent. I've just drawn them in different colors so you can see what happens. So HCP is obtained by layering two triangular lattices in three dimensions. If I rotate this by 60 degrees, you actually see it's not a symmetry because it takes red sites to blue sites. But if I rotate it by 60 degrees and translate by C over 2 along that rotation axis, it is actually a symmetry of the crystal. The same way, it turns out there's a lattice in 2D called the Shastri-Sutherland lattice. I've just drawn a pattern. People in frustrated magnetism know this quite well. If you reflect this lattice about this line I drew here, it's actually not a symmetry. But if I reflect this lattice and translate it by a half lattice spacing, it is actually a symmetry. And it turns out you can show that those two symmetries, no matter how you chose to represent the symmetry of this crystal, no matter where you place the origin of the crystal, there would always be some symmetry in these crystals that's a combination of a reflection followed by a fractional translation or a rotation followed by a fractional translation. There's no way to represent the symmetries of this crystal in a way that avoids these fractional translations. There's absolutely no way to do it. And it turns out that that's one of the simplest ways of classifying crystals into two types. And it turns out that that special symmetry, except in two cases. So when we did this proof, we were able to do 155 cases with one argument. And then we spent about 2 months coming up with an argument for two special cases. So I'm not going to talk about those two special cases, even though we spent the most time on those. Essentially, this special symmetry produces the destructive interference that kills Bragg peaks, basically. So let me just remind you, I'll give you crystallography in 60 seconds, so you know it's the sausage that nobody wants to see made. You take 32 point groups and 14 Bravais lattices, you put them together, and you get 230 space groups. And the way to see it is, suppose I take a space group, I just take a crystal that represents, I take some pattern that's supposed to represent the symmetry of that group. I just look everywhere in that crystal and ask, is there a point that in the crystal where if I do a point group operation on it, so I know the point group that went into the crystal, right? So if I do a point group operation on that point, what could happen? The point could be invariant, or it could get shifted. If it gets shifted, I'll always argue I want to map it back to this unit cell by a lattice translation. Because if it goes to another unit cell, I can just pull it back by lattice translation. If there's a single point that's left invariant under all these operations, then the crystal is symorphic. And if there's no such point, the crystal is non-symorphic. So it's very easy to construct those points. If I take the honeycomb lattice, one way to see that is if I take honeycombs and sit in the center, you can. This has some D6 symmetry, the symmetry of a regular hexagon. You can see that that point that I marked with an X is invariant under every point group operation, no matter what I do. Right? So that point is completely invariant. You can never construct a point like that on the diamond lattice. I can't draw a diamond nicely here. I've got some pictures of it later. But if you play around with the diamond lattice, you can never construct such a point. And both those lattices I drew on the board earlier, you can never construct such a single point that's invariant under all the symmetries. And so this idea of extinctions, that the fact that these crystals have systematic extinctions suggests that maybe we should look at these non-symorphic crystals more carefully, because maybe that's where you can use extra symmetries to make some statement about what the kind of fractionalized phases you can get are. So let me just show you again what these operations are. For 2D, you can have these mirror operations where you reflect the crystal, it's not a symmetry, and then you translate it by half of a lattice spacing and the pattern goes back to itself. Right? It's very important that that translation is a fraction. That's going to be crucial. So the idea is now, this is also a blown up picture of what I showed earlier. You rotate by 60 degrees and translate up through towards you, and you can see that's the symmetry of this hexagonal closed packed structure. So you can run the same argument I gave you about this flux insertion. That always works. There's nothing that stops me from inserting flux in the system. So I can run it for various choices of direction to insert the flux. Each choice of flux insertion will actually break some symmetries, right? Because I'm choosing a preferred axis that encircles this flux. But let me say that axis is in the invariant subspace of my operation. So let's say it's parallel to a rotation axis or along a reflection axis. Let's always do that. As long as I insert flux along those axes, if you think about putting boundary conditions, it means that I always have boundary conditions that are consistent on every plane of that symmetry operation, so I'm safe. Now, I want to find the smallest S, so that if this filling is a multiple of S, there's a unique ground state allowed. That's what I want to try and do. And it turns out that because they have these extinctions, you can always show that that S is going to be bigger than 1. This is a unique property of a space group. You can define this as the non-symorphic, what we call the non-symorphic rank of the group. It's just a number. If I hand you a space group, there's a finite number of computations you can do to determine this number. And that number is a property of the group. It can go into the group table along with it. And it's actually something that in crystallography constrains it to be 1, 2, 3, 4, or 6. That's because you don't have any 5-fold symmetries in a true 3D crystal or any other symmetries. These are only 6-fold symmetries. Only these are the symmetries that you're allowed. And it turns out you can just do very simply, the 73 symorphic space groups will always have this equal to 1. That means that as long as you have any integer multiple filling, you're allowed to have a unique ground state for this system. But the 157 non-symorphic space groups you can check, it turns out you don't do it exhaustively. You just have an argument that shows you that 155 of them have S greater than 1, and the remaining 2 you have to check carefully. All the remaining 157 of them have S bigger than 1. You can guarantee that. And it turns out this S is something you can, again, as I said, you can label all your space groups with this and put this in there. It's the minimum filling at which a featureless insulator is allowed in that space group. So now it remains to us to figure out what the different U1 charges are. Different cases, I might think of different U1 charges to define. If I have a spin model, I may choose a particular U1 symmetry. If I have charges, I may choose a U1 symmetry. If I have spinful fermions, I may choose a different U1. The precise definition of what I mean by the symmetry, the charge in the system. But as long as I can identify a charge and a charge per unit cell, I have to have this constraint. If the charge is not a multiple of S, you're never going to get a unique ground state. It's impossible. So let's see where this takes us. And I'll go back to how you can prove, and maybe I should pause. Can everybody see why this argument, the kind of way I would prove this argument is? Earlier I was saying, let me take this crystal and thread flux. I got a ground state that was different from the original one because they had different crystal momenta. Here I said, let me take this crystal, thread flux. The original and final ground states have the same crystal momentum, but if I actually measure the quantum number of one of these weird symmetry operations, that quantum number has changed. So they have different values of a certain symmetry operation. That's enough for me to distinguish those two states. That's really the way I'm going to run this argument. So let's see where this would take us. So remember I said there's this band theory problem, whether you can actually, given exactly 1 spinless fermion per unit cell, and the freedom to build any model that's local consistent with those symmetries without interactions, can I construct a band insulator? So this is what Ashcroft and Merman, if you picked up your textbook, would say, that if you have an even number of electrons, you can always get a band insulator. That's completely wrong, because if you have one spinless fermion per unit cell, it's not always sufficient. So let's imagine we take the diamond lattice, and let's imagine putting a spinless fermion per unit cell of the diamond lattice, right? Which is what Ashcroft and Merman arguments would tell you. You should always be able to construct a band insulator given enough freedom. On the diamond lattice, in this sense, only when there are two spinless fermions per unit cell can you ever construct an insulator. And the reason for that is that, and okay, you can associate this crystal, for every crystal you can associate this integer. And what this tells you is that there's a constraint on bands, there's a band sticking constraint. So band insulators are featureless. They have no symmetry breaking, and they have a unique ground state by definition. You can check there's no ground state degeneracy of a band insulator. So we know that that must be forbidden except at certain fillings. So it says, if I have enough fermions, so I'm not including spin at this point, so if I have enough fermions to fully fill one band, or three bands, or five bands, or any odd number of bands, in this diamond lattice, I should never be able to get a band insulator. That's what it tells me. Because it says a featureless insulator is forbidden. In particular, a band insulator is forbidden, right? Because that's featureless. That tells me that the bands have to stick together in multiples of two. There's no way to avoid that. So any consistent band structure on the diamond lattice will have the following pattern. That so on the top, on all these pictures, you see that these bands stick together along certain points. On certain faces, the bands are just stuck together. They don't disperse at all. And that has to do with the fact that if you work out the diamond lattice, it has a symmetry operation that gives it, you know, there's a weird symmetry here where you can rotate by 90 degrees and translate by a quarter of a lattice spacing. And it turns out that if you do the calculation very carefully, you can show that diamond has this rank, is a rank 2 lattice. And on any rank 2 lattice, until you break a symmetry, you can never get a band structure that looks like that. So it tells you that the rank is telling you the minimal number of bands that you need to represent the crystal. You can never get a single isolated band in these crystals. And it turns out that there were sort of hints in band theory literature by various people, including a sort of vague attempt at a proof by Laurent Michel and Joshua Zak. In fact, they gave a proof, but they did it in a very complicated way. What they asked was, let's ask what the most general Wannier states we can construct consistent with all the symmetries. And let's ask, how many bands do I need to construct? How are the minimal set of bands I need to keep to construct these maximally symmetric Wannier states? And it turns out that if you had a non-symmorphic crystal, you need, if you get maximally symmetric 1A orbitals, which are invariant under all the symmetries of the crystal, you need to keep more than two bands. So in some sense, I was like looking at some band theory papers and came across that result, which is where this whole theory started, was looking at that result and finding a way to generalize that to interacting systems. And along the way, we found a simple proof for non-interacting systems, which doesn't require about 80 pages of algebra and representation theory.
But this is so, does essentially follow from having a degeneracy in some point of the band structure, or?
Which the yeah, so they did it a non-interacting thing. Uh-huh. So actually, it's a little subtle. When you have a degeneracy in the band structure, in sort of formal terms, it's saying that the little group of the symmetry operations at that point, the little group of the space group at that point, has a non-abelian representation, right? It has a representation that requires you to have at least two states. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that the reason it's non-abelian is either because it's fundamentally non-abelian or it's projective. But it turns out there's also a case where cases where there's something that Herring noticed long time ago, 1937, introduced this thing called monodromy, which is actually probably the first topological argument in crystals. So in 1937, he had a topological argument. What he showed was, suppose I take some representation. It's a purely abelian representation. So it's a one-dimensional representation of the bands. And let me sort of go through some high symmetry loop in K-space. Let me go through the K-space structure and come out on the other side. He showed that the identity would have changed. So if you started off with the identity being mapped to 1, you end up back being with some operator being mapped to -1. So that tells you that you had to go through some phase slip along the way. There had to be a band crossing because you need to go twice. So it showed there's some sort of vortex in the representations as you go around. And he proved this by just explicit enumeration. He showed that if you match all these bands, you have to go across and come back. There's no consistent way to do it in diamond. So he has this paper called The Character Tables for Two Space Groups, where he worked out, this is the place if you look for the citations for the band structure of HCP and diamond, that's where it is. And if you work it out, that's exactly how it works out, the story.
So is this related to the condition to get Dirac semimetals?
Absolutely. It turns out that the condition for Dirac semimetals, the fact that you want to look at zone boundaries and non-symmorphic space groups which have inversion. So you know there's this long story of why you get them, you know, in this paper by Saad Zahir. I can reproduce the argument for you in about 3 minutes. It turns out that with non-interacting systems, that's a trivial argument. There's nothing particularly interesting. The only thing is, the important thing in that paper, if you like, is chemistry, is getting the Fermi level at the Dirac point. There's no interesting physics there in the sense that pointing out that there's a fourfold degeneracy is not very difficult, that it should always be there. Well, we can say that ex post facto. The fact that they were first to do it means it's still interesting. But it's really the important thing, there's a material where the chemical potential sits at the Dirac point. The fact that there are fourfold band touchings, it turns out any centrosymmetric non-symmorphic crystal will always have fourfold degeneracies at zone boundaries, at translation, at time reversal invariant momenta. It's just a fact, you can prove it. And so another thing you can do is say the HCP lattice has the same band structure, and you can do that. And so this, all this required is a conserved U1 charge. It made no assumption about interactions, and I'll probably just quickly run through this. So it tells you that you can work with the conserved SZ. So if you take spin a half moments of the diamond lattice, you can argue that, run through this quickly. If you take spin a half moments of the diamond lattice, it tells you that a spin gap ground state must break symmetry or be a spin liquid, again, because it can't have a unique ground state. And another thing you can do is talk about magnetization plateaus. So this compound, the Shastri-Sutherland compound I told you earlier, people have done these sort of magnetization plateau states. You can think of these as featureless as insulators of bosons in some Bose-Hubbard representation. And it turns out there's a magnetization plateau that corresponds to filling 1. And this crystal has rank 2. And so you can show that this magnetization plateau has to break symmetry or be fractionalized. Sort of a non-trivial result without having done any modeling of that system. We know something about its magnetization plateaus. And so what it also tells you is, so I will skip through this. It turns out that if you know that the thing you want to do is to build a featureless phase, is to put all the charge in the, so why could you not put a featureless phase? The idea is that you want to stick all the charge in the system at a high symmetry point, and there's more than one high symmetry point in these crystals. So unless you have 2 charges per unit cell, you have to fractionalize the charge to sit it at 2 high symmetry points, if you like. That's why you could only do it at you have to have fractionalization to get this to work. So the basic point is that if you're saying that the way to construct a featureless phase is to stick all the charge at the high symmetry point, you can try to construct orbitals that do that, and they give you some nice interesting entangled wave functions for the honeycomb. And in fact, if you go back and ask why were we able to construct such a trial wave function for the honeycomb that was featureless but also gapped, it's because we were able to construct wave functions that effectively put all the charge at this high symmetry point in the center of the hexagons. That's the secret. So that gives you a way to construct systematic trial wave functions whenever a featureless phase is allowed. So it turns out that you can also argue that, here's the following way, if you have a single particle per unit cell, you start with classical particles in a fixed number site, if you have 1 particle per unit cell, right? Well, you can have a slightly more complicated example where you have many sites in the unit cell, but here you could imagine just delocalizing the charge across those 4 sites, and this also still builds an insulator at 1 charge per unit cell. And it turns out that this intuition can be thought of in terms of polarization. That is, you want to put the center of the charge at a high symmetry point. That's basically what you're trying to do. And it turns out this is a very old idea. It goes back to Walter Cohn talking about the theory of the insulating state, who invented these polarization arguments. I think maybe 2 minutes, is that okay?
Yeah.
And so the idea is that the fact that these things are all connected, the flux threading, the sensitivity, boundary conditions, and polarization are all the same, were noticed by a whole number of people, actually people working in sort of more band structure kind of calculations because it's tied to questions of 1A functions and polarization. And it turns out you can also interpret this Liebschultz-Mattis argument in terms of polarization. Basically, the idea is that one way of defining the polarization for a crystal is some complicated formula. Basically, what you're doing here is this operator here twists the boundary conditions, and you ask about the overlap of the ground state with the twisted boundary condition ground state. And if you take an appropriate limit of that, that turns out to be a working definition of the polarization, of the many-body polarization. And so the idea is that you can do some clever arguments that basically combine this. What you can show is that this operator here is something that's labeled by reciprocal lattice vector, because it's telling you if I give you a crystal and ask, how can I twist the boundary conditions? The correct way of thinking about all the fluxes you can insert in the crystal is exactly the reciprocal lattice. If you draw a picture, you'll find that out quickly. The reason is that you want to insert a gauge flux, which means you want to insert 2 pi flux, but you want to insert 2 pi flux in a direction that if you go in any direction that's not parallel to that, you don't enclose 2 pi flux. And so you want a set of vectors for your flux insertions that are defined by bi dot aj equals 2 pi delta ij. You want some vectors b that satisfy that for a in the lattice itself. Because that's the way you can guarantee that when you insert a flux, it's actually a gauge flux for any orbit around the crystal. Right? So 2 pi flux inserted parallel to b is 2 pi flux for all directions by that argument. For any motion on the crystal. So it turns out that the reciprocal lattice has an interpretation as the set of flux insertions that are gauge equivalent to 0, if you like. That's one way of phrasing the reciprocal lattice for an interacting system. And if you do that, then the idea is that if you look at these polarizations, you say, well, I want to twist by this UK and then check what happens. So you say that the polarization is proportional to this. If you can show that this UK changes a quantum number of psi naught, you're done, because you can argue that there's no way to represent that on a unique ground state. So you can actually do this. You can actually show that there's a symmetry of the many-body ground state subspace that is not respected. You can sort of run the same arguments that you would do to show that there's band touchings at certain points in terms of many-body states. You can show that if I start with a certain many-body ground state, thread flux, I end up in another many-body ground state, which is distinct from the original one. In this language, it's possible. So I rephrase this entirely. And it turns out the way to think about that, there's a reformulation of crystallography and classification of space groups entirely in terms of Bragg peaks done by David Merman, in fact, when he was thinking about quasi-crystals. And it turns out you can translate all this into that language, and it's extremely transparent. It works. It turns out to be about 15 minutes to do the whole thing. And the reason it's kind of nice is because that's what allows you to prove these two cases that I said took 2 months to do. It's because we had to understand that this was the way to do it, and then it was very easy. You have to sort of think in this more abstract sense of what it means to define polarization. But the bottom line is that you cannot define the polarization at all for this thing. So I think this was just trying to be more specific about what you're doing in this flux insertion process. I think I motivated that. Let me just stop with a summary.
Questions.
Yep.
So I'd like to rise in defense of Ashcroft and Merman. I recently taught a course based on
okay.
I think what they say is that having an even number of electrons per unit cell is a necessary but not sufficient condition
right.
for having
okay.
an insulator. So
yeah.
do you disagree with
maybe
this,
I don't disagree. It's necessary but not sufficient. I seem to remember it saying it more strongly. Where they do make a mistake, which I'm actually surprised that they never fixed it, because Merman thought a lot about this, is that if you look at what they define to be non-symmorphic space groups, that's where they really mess up, because they say it has glide planes and screw axes, which is actually wrong, because if you look at honeycomb, you can see that there's a glide plane in the honeycomb. Mm-hmm. The reason it's not really non-symmorphic is because I can change the origin and make it go away. So really what they should have said is it has these glide planes and screw axes, and you can never represent them without that. They're not very clear on this point. So I agree. What I'm saying is that the sort of general note of Ashcroft and Merman is that they don't look at any symmetry. In some sense, they sort of talk about band structure, but they don't look at any symmetries beyond that. So saying that Ashcroft and Merman is wrong is not exactly right. But often that statement is made beyond that. You know, you sort of say even number of electrons per unit cell is boring. It's sort of the impression that you get. Mm-hmm. But what this is there are odd numbers of electrons per unit cell that are even number of electrons per unit cell that are just as interesting as odd for most crystals. And I think that's a fairly important point that's basically not in the book at all. Which is not fair. It's not that they missed it. It's just something that wasn't known. It was a few rare examples. If you look at any group theory book, it's clear that these ideas were sort of floating around. If you look at Heine's old classic book on group theory, he says, I find these many examples, and there must be a universal proof of this, but I don't know one. Right? So he makes that point that there should be some simple proof that this always works, but he doesn't have a proof in there. And really, Michel and Zach were the ones who gave this proof. But it's some obscure PRB that has, like, 5 citations all by them. So it's unfortunate because I think it's a beautiful result that they obtained for non-interacting systems. It's a very, very elegant formulation. It's just that people just didn't know that this was a natural consequence. But for the interacting systems case, they didn't realize that it had these implications. So that was us, this interacting thing. And along the way, you find an elementary way to prove it for non-interacting systems because it sort of works as a corollary. Yeah.
Questions? Where can I find this Merman reference to that was mentioned towards the end of the
book? I'm happy to share it with you. It's a series of papers by Merman. The original papers are Roxar, Merman, and Wright, where they were trying to classify all quasicrystals. And that's why you want to work in Fourier space, because the way they define a quasicrystal is anything that has a good Bragg pattern. And then if you want to talk about symmetries, you never want to talk about real space. You only want to talk about Fourier space. And then they show that classifying all possible quasicrystals is a problem of cohomology. It's a very elementary problem. For them, it's an elementary problem in cohomology, the way they phrase it, and it's just dumb. But you can actually find, there's actually an American Journal of Physics article that is actually an elementary article on how these symmetries are related to band crossings. And we actually summarize it all in the supplement of that paper. We summarize these arguments, so you sort of reconstruct it from there, and there are references there, which you'll do a much better job than me of writing what Merman did. We just did it for completeness, but the papers, Merman's original papers are really good. And so they're all in the supplement of our paper. Yep.
I was wondering, you said the language, you said like missing Bragg peaks. So
yeah.
What were you comparing that to? Like what was
suppose I gave you a crystal, right? You have two pieces of information. You have a point group and you have a reciprocal lattice. And when you think about Bragg scattering, the only information you first put in is saying the reciprocal lattice is the, you know, when I think of the translation subgroup of the space group, that defines the reciprocal lattice naively. So it tells you the reciprocal lattice. But remember, you have a point group that's additional symmetries on top of that. So one way of phrasing this question is, I know that all reciprocal lattices naively are Bravais lattices, right? Because they're just Fourier transforms of the real space lattice. So where did the richness of space groups go in K-space? Because, you know, you went from 230 to 14. What happened? Well, all the others are the fact that each of these will have different patterns of missing peaks. Actually, 155 of them will have missing patterns of peaks. Two of them will not be distinguishable that way, but in two of them, you'll find that any band structure will always have degeneracies. There's some subtlety there, but yeah, that's where this structure went away. So it's relative to what you would expect from the translational part of the algebra. Just translation would give you some one of the 14 Bravais lattices in K-space now, and then you'll see something missing from those 14 Bravais lattices, and that's why. Yeah?
Well, maybe in the interest of time, we should stop here. And then...
Yeah. Sorry, I went a bit late.